This is Pure Decking, show number 454 for Thursday, October the 21st. I forgot to look up this year in history. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and trying to figure out when I lost the plot. I am presently drinking an Angry Orchard, and we have a madman. What's up, madman?
The plot was lost officially in 1974, and I've gone with Sam Adams' Oktoberfest.
I was talking to Suave about this earlier. I have some of that in the fridge, too, and it's good. I had gotten a pack of various steaks and burgers and stuff, and one of the things in there were these sausages, which were apple, Gouda cheese, and chicken sausages. And I thought
that doesn't sound bad.
No, it doesn't sound bad at all. And I thought, well, if I browned those up in a pan and then boiled them in some Sam Adams Oktoberfest, that would probably come out pretty good, you'd think, right?
I think you did it in the wrong order. Generally, you boil it in the beer and then brown it.
Oh. They didn't have much flavor. Like, I mean, they weren't, like, bad. They just didn't taste like anything. You know, you didn't hardly get any of the flavor out of them. So it was like, it was kind of disappointing. So, you know, I was kind of hoping that, you know, because you're like, well, it's chicken, right? You got to flavor chicken. So boiling it in the beer would be a good way to get some flavor in there. But I guess not. I don't know. But, you know, if you're right. I mean, if I could have done it the other way around, I guess. Yes, DPView, the Sam Adams Oktoberfest is quite good. I need to get some more of it while it's still a thing.
I do look forward to their cold snap every year. It's a little bit before that comes out.
Yeah.
So. Oh, and Old Fizzy Wiggle, just because I like saying the name.
But I'm usually
and it's
not,
also a good beer.
I'm usually not big on like sausages and breakfast sausage I like well enough, but usually not super huge on like brats and things like that. So I don't know, just never really. It's like they're not bad. I just never really got into them, you know. So I tried it. And it's kind of. I mean, it wasn't bad. I was just kind of disappointed that it wasn't better. You know what I mean? So. Anyways, well, next time I decided to do culinary experimentations, I'll run it by you first, Madman, since you're better at it than I am.
And if you ever want to try a bunch of sausages, you've got to try the Audubon. You look up where it is. It's the name of a all-you-can-eat buffet that does nothing but sausage and sides. And all of the sausage is made in the restaurant.
Oh, well, there's the problem. See, you find one you like, and you can't get anywhere but the restaurant. So it's like,
yep, and it might not be there the next time you show up, because they'll experiment. It's like, this one's made from pork, lamb, and seasoned with jalapenos. And you might not get that the next four times you show up.
So, anyways, I guess we'll get into the first link here. It's from NPR. I had this link, or you sent me this link somewhere else. It was like the report.media or something like that, but I ended up going with the NPR link. Sinclair Broadcast Group says it suffered a ransomware attack and has had data stolen. So Sinclair is the company that runs probably your local news. I mean, they own a lot of them. They run a lot of local news. The big video they put together about this is dangerous to our democracy a couple of years back, that was all from Sinclair people reading a script. So if your news station read that script on air, guess what? They're owned by Sinclair Broadcast Group. So, and I think it's kind of fun to see companies that are in kind of the public eye but aren't hospitals or major manufacturers getting the ransomware, because, you know, frankly, hitting the TV off for a day is probably not going to hurt anybody. But just, you know,
it could actually be helpful. To be away from a screen for 48, 50 hours.
Well, I was talking about this earlier. I've got a topic I was thinking would be fun to discuss with you guys on the show, but with I'd like RU to be here for it. I'd like to get Fox in on it too, but kind of discussing kind of the disparity between everybody's kind of living in multiple worlds these days. You've got the real world, you know, where you're interacting with people, you're experiencing things yourself, you know, even if it's just going to work, supermarket, dealing with your animal, you know, your pets and stuff, right? Your family. But then you've got this entire other world that's fed to you through the screens, whether it's you're watching TV, you're getting it on the internet, or, you know, not interacting with people, not like what we do when we're hanging out with the, you know, gaming. I mean, like watching YouTube videos or reading articles or watching TV. You know, it's passive. You're just kind of getting the information. You're not, you know, or listening to podcasts. It's not interactive. You know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, this kind of gives you these two different realities that you're dealing with, kind of like a cognitive dissonance, because they don't line up, you know.
And the screen reality isn't shared, because that screen reality, it isn't new. But before, when it was being fed to us by the television rather than the internet, and especially the early days of television and even radio, there was a set number of channels that you could watch. So we were all watching the same five channels, and depending on the day, not all of them had good programming on, so we were probably watching even the same shows and getting similar news. Now, we can all watch a television show, which we think is great, and no one else has not even seen it, but might not have even heard of it. I like The Expanse on Amazon. No one in my family knew it existed. So, yeah, so we're not, it's not just that it's a fed reality, it's a fed reality that's
no longer
limited to either just me or even a small group, especially once you go into podcasts.
Oh, yeah, because now you've got, you know, I'm watching different videos and reading different things than you are, than everybody else on the channel is, than my family is. And so, yeah, you know, our view of what's real is shaped by that. You know, I mean, the classic example of this is the person who watches Fox News all day versus the person who watches MSNBC all day, right? They're not even going to agree on what the nature of reality is. And, you know, whether that's good or bad, well, you know, we can get into that debate. But, I mean, you know, neither one of them is going to be exactly dead on what's real. Now, you might argue one channel is better than the other in that regard, but since they're both mostly opinion these days, that's you know.
I think it might even be slightly worse than that, because at least if you're doing Fox News and CNN, they're arguing over the same stories. It's just which point of view or which facts are the most relevant they're arguing about. Once you get into podcasts, you can get into stories that aren't even on some news channels.
Well, I mean, that's something I try to do with Decking, is I try to pick stuff that's, you know, I haven't seen anywhere else, usually. Now, not always, and then I have a couple of podcasts I haven't been listening to as much that I used to listen to, that usually when we beat them to, you know, like when we did a story on Decking like a week before they did on the other podcast, it's like, yeah, you know, that always felt good. But, you know, it was one of these things where it's like, But even that, you know, is that real? No, because you're reading out these articles as fast as they come out. And nowadays, half of them are generated by AI and are really just ads. So, I mean, I've had a hell of a time getting stories lately for decking that are actually worth reading. That's the other thing, is it's like, dude, I mean, for God's sake, everything is nothing but Facebook this week. Oh, they're being indicted. And I've got a Facebook story because I wanted to follow up on it since it's one we've talked about before. But, oh, they're being indicted. Oh, they're changing their name. Oh, this and that. And it's like, you guys do realize the internet is more than just Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, right? I mean, does nobody else remember that? That the internet is more than just Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube? So, I don't know. Anyways, back to the article here. Got sidetracked. But yeah, that shared reality thing, that's something I want to explore more. I'd like to get a bigger crew on to actually, you know, talk about it. Because I don't know what that means, but I think it's the start of figuring out why the world's so damn broken.
Well, it means balkanization. I mean, I know it's something you want to go into a bit more, but that's what it's going to break down to meaning.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, but it's almost like a hyper-balkanization. So, maybe that's why you're seeing people get into fist fights in the street with bike locks and the people wearing, you know, full-on SWAT gear to tackle each other over, you know, over who won the presidential election or something. I mean, it's like, really? Anyways, Sinclair Broadcast Group, which operates dozens of TV stations across the U.S., said Monday that some of its servers and workstations were encrypted with ransomware and that some of its data was stolen from the company's network. The company said it started investigating the potential security threat on Saturday, and on Sunday, it found that certain office and operational networks were disrupted. The Hunt Valley, Maryland-based company, owns and or operates 21 regional sports networks and owns, operates, or provides services to 185 television stations in 86 markets. The broadcast group, which is known for pushing a conservative viewpoint through editorials and reports that it compels its stations to run, did not immediately say how many TV stations were directly affected. Nashville, Tennessee's WZTV put out a notice on its website Monday about serious technical issues at the TV station affecting its ability to stream content. Quote, "We are also currently unable to access our email and your phone calls to the station," unquote, it said. Sinclair said it's taken measures to contain the incident and that its forensic investigation is ongoing. However, the company said the data breach has caused and may continue to cause disruptions to parts of its business, including certain aspects of local advertisements by local broadcast stations on behalf of its customers. Boo fucking who, you can't play ads. I realize that's how you fund your company, and to you guys that's the end of the world, but everybody else doesn't care that they're going to see less ads for a bit. Sinclair, well, I guess if you're the people paying for the advertising, you might care, too.
People paying for the advertising and anyone who wants a paycheck.
That works at these companies, yeah. Sinclair said it currently can't determine whether or not the data breach will have a material impact on its business, operations, or financial results. Yes. Just, it's in the news. It's going to impact your public visibility. I don't know if they're publicly traded or not. It will have an impact. I'm just going to save you some trouble. The answer to that one is yes. No ransomware group immediately took credit for the incident. Ransomware attacks in which cyber criminals encrypt an organization's data and then demand payment to unscramble it are a growing scourge in the United States. The Biden administration has pledged to disrupt and prosecute criminal networks like the ones that attacked U.S. major pipeline company in May. The attack on the Colonial Pipeline, which led to gas shortages along the East Coast, was attributed to a Russia-based gang of cyber criminals, which has absolutely nothing to do with the current story other than they're both ransomware. Ransomware payments reached more than $400 million globally in 2020 and topped $81 million in the first quarter of 2021, according to the U.S. government. Several media outlets have been hit by ransomware attacks in recent years. Cox Media Group, a major media conglomerate, said recently it was the target of a ransomware attack earlier this year, and a ransomware attack briefly knocked the Weather Channel off the air in 2019. Sinclair shares declined about 3.3% in afternoon trading. So, yes, it is publicly traded. I didn't see that line earlier. So, yeah, it will affect your bottom line. But especially if you're saying it's going to impact your ad business, because that's how you make your money. So,
I guess the better question is, how long term is it going to affect their bottom line?
Depending on how their IT is
run. Not even a bad quarter, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, it will. But, you know, I used to say this stuff would do kind of reputational harm, but enough big companies have gotten hit with these ransomware scams and, you know, came out of it. Yeah, they got to pay for identity theft protection for a few people, and yeah, they've got a few other things they got to deal with. But really, it's not doing the kind of brand damage I would expect a big ransomware attack to do to these companies, you know? So
it also kind of depends on the company that's getting hit, because some of the ones that are the big companies that are thinking of, like Equifax,
mm-hmm.
the reason it didn't hurt them is I'm not their customer, and I have no choice but to have them, you know, do business.
Well, and a lot of their stuff is pre-contractual anyways, so it would be as contracts come up with them, people deciding not to continue business with them, which gives them plenty of time to say, oh, no, we fixed it, you know. But there have been others, you know, Target, and, you know, they mentioned several others in their Cox. So, you know, Chase, you know, credit card thing happened a while back with AWS. But, yeah, I would expect more brand damage to be coming out of this, but it hasn't been. So maybe my entire industry is wrong, and as long as you can recover from it relatively quickly and make your mea culpas, it just doesn't do the kind of brand damage we think it should do.
Which, one problem with it preventing it from doing brand damage is how quickly is the news moving on from it?
Well, considering these are people who put out the news, I would say relatively quickly.
Well, on this one, yes. But even with the Target hit, how many weeks was it in the news?
Well, the one I'm actually thinking of most recently was the AWS stuff with Chase, because in our industry, anyways, you and I, you know, the auditors were going nuts for that stuff. So they were chasing our IT teams around for cloud stuff, for AWS stuff, for at least a year with audits and questions and you know, deciding that they were changing, because of this incident, they're changing how they rate things and they need all this new information. You know, I'm speaking of the government audits, right? But,
yeah,
but I mean, that really only impacts IT teams inside of companies and audit and risks teams. It doesn't really, like, stick in the mind of the average person for very long if the news doesn't sit there and harp on it. So unless it is something like the pipeline is down and that's affecting gas to everybody, I mean.
And audits, that's not reputational damage.
No, they may end up having to pay some stuff on the back end, but even that rarely actually comes out in public.
Reputational damage is like what happened to KFC in the late 90s, early 2000s when PETA did the hit piece on them and put out a documentary saying the chickens are being horribly treated and if you eat at KFC, you're an evil bastard.
Didn't they fund a bunch of fake news stories about people finding rodents in the chicken too?
Yeah, and I know people to this day that won't eat at KFC because of that. But this was a concerted effort over months. It wasn't a few news stories in a 24-hour news cycle or a week of inconvenience. It was months of hammering them.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, you got to overcome, you know, a company like KFC is going to have a massive advertising campaign to try to counter that. Because I know a couple of other groups have gone after, like, Taco Bell, trying to say, you know, and so Taco Bell did a big thing saying, oh, no, it's 100% beef, because there was some study came out that said like half of what was in the beef was sawdust or something like that. And again, it, you know, then they come out later and said that was from some activist group trying to impact the business, which rightly or wrongly, I mean, and then it's like, well, which one's real? Of course, Taco Bell's going to tell you everything in there's perfect. And of course, the activist group that wants to shut them down is going to tell you that it's all horrible. So what's the truth? You know, you kind of like to know what the real answer is, and you don't get it. So,
and on the it's 100% beef, That answer may be 100% true and still be completely misleading, because they're not saying what grade the beef is. And here's something that will sicken many people. For a long time, McDonald's was the world's leading purchaser of cow eyeballs. They're 100% beef.
Yeah, but what he's not telling you is they were going in the salad. No, I'm kidding. It's like, what are you guys doing with all the cow eyes? Making chicken nuggets? Wait, what?
That freaked me out. And I'm still sad that they went to their all-white meat recipe. I think it was better when they had some dark meat mixed in with the chicken nuggets.
It's like, what else are you guys buying? Cow hooves for what? The ice cream machines. Wait, what?
We're moving into Jell-O.
It's like, no, we throw one in the ice cream machine to break it every once in a while. That's why they're always broken, right?
Yeah. For reputational damage, it must be persistent.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these stories aren't. Now, Equifax got hit pretty badly for a long time, but you're right. They were in a market where it's really hard to do long-term reputational damage with their actual customers.
So. And I think one thing that also is somewhat helping many of these companies is it's not always the company you're dealing with direct, like the Target one. It wasn't Target that got popped. It was,
it was a waste management. Their,
yeah, it was one of their vendors.
So.
Now, I think companies, to an extent, can be held responsible for their vendors, but then there's also the question of how much should that extent be? Because I can audit them a bit, but it's still a separate company.
Well, I mean, you're choosing whether to do business with them or not, and whether they can meet your organizational security requirements. So you have to be sure, you have to have all that documented up front too, because you can't come back to them after the fact and say, well, our requirement was that you not get hacked. I know the credit card companies, what's that, PCR? No. Shoot. I've forgotten the name of the standard that the credit card companies use, but, their standard is that if you have a breach, you're now no longer in compliance. So I mean, it's like really bad. It's like, no, you need real standards. You can't just say if breached, you lose. I mean, but a lot of things act like that. So, when you're dealing with the vendors, you got to have your standards laid out up front, and many of them will claim they can meet it, whether or not they really can. And, if you find out later they're not, well, they're in breach of contract, but if you got to prove that in court after the fact, after a big ransomware attack, I mean, really, that's not going to, that never plays well. So, but I mean, it's becoming common enough that I don't think you're going to, that's my point, is that it's becoming common enough that it just kind of rolls off anymore. It's like, oh yeah, more computer problems. I mean, it's like the Windows box popping up. Are you sure you want to do this? Everybody just clicks yes. They don't read the damn thing. It kind of defeats the point, So.
I think to fix it, we may have to start blaming the victim. Like, you were wearing an awfully short skirt. Maybe you shouldn't have been doing that, Equifax. You really were asking for it. Maybe we need to.
Well, we make the automotive.
To send you to finishing school.
Yeah, you make the automotive companies do all these recalls because you hold them responsible if you have defects in the design. Maybe you ought to hold companies responsible if their IT infrastructure has defects in it. I mean, no two companies run the same network. They have to design their stuff. So,
off the shelf security patches aren't that watertight, is what I'm hearing.
It's not – so 9 times out of 10 with modern security, dude, it's not whether they're patched or not. Yes, unpatched systems are a problem. So if you've got unpatched systems on the internet, you're asking for it. Don't get me wrong. But if I'm doing a modern assessment, I'm going to run the scanner and look for any easy ways in, like, an unpatched Windows XP box that's vulnerable to MS-0867. Sure. Am I going to look for that? Yes. Because I can, and because it's easy, and if you find one, it's a game over win. But that's not how most people get in these days. Most people get in either through flaws in the logic of an application, most applications are web-based these days. So, yes, I'm talking about web pages. So, you know, where I can do code injection, SQL injection on a web page, or I can get your website to return a bunch of data to me that it shouldn't. Or I go for a social engineering attack. You know, I go on LinkedIn, I looked up who works at your company, and I spam them with phishing email so somebody in your company clicks the link, I get root on their computer, and I start to go to town from there. I don't bother with going for unpatched vulnerabilities, or I don't, you know, trying to find Windows machines that aren't up to date. Now, if you find, unpatched vulnerabilities in their web software, hey, that can be a way in. But again, 9 times out of 10, you have much better luck with either the social engineering attacks or attacking the business logic of what they've put together.
E-cards. Oh, fuck, yeah. E-cards. Here's a spooky Halloween e-card. Click this link to send one to a friend. Yeah, don't click the link, guys. Click the link.
Well, what's even more fun is when your marketing department sends out shit that actually matches your spam training so well.
Did you accidentally block your marketing department?
Oh, no.
Because they were sending malicious emails?
No.
That would be fucking amazing.
Well, okay, yes. But more recently than that, you know, they demand all the internal email addresses be whitelisted from the filters because we wouldn't accidentally want to block anything internally, which actually 9 times out of 10 is probably a reasonable rule to set in your spam filter. No. What happens is marketing will send out some company-wide blast that looks so much like the spam phishing emails we send out to test people that they will flood my security questions boxes with, "We got this from marketing. Is this real?" It's great that I've got 150 people who are paying attention saying, "This looks like a fish. Should I click the link?" The problem is that now I've got one guy who's spending all day answering these questions saying, "Yes, it's from our marketing department. Yes, they're stupid. Yes, we know." Yes, we know they didn't. They made it look just like a phishing email. And the problem is not it's obnoxious that 150 people ask. That actually means the phishing training is working. So I shouldn't be complaining. But what's worse is it's like, okay, I have 150 people that have asked me this. Where's the other 700 people who got that email who aren't sure if it's a fish or not? Did they just click the link? I'll bet they did. So.
Good news. If your marketing team ever goes unemployed, they can start their own fishing business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got the damn templates down. I'll tell you what. It's like, who looks at a phishing email and says, "That's what we're going to use for the next marketing campaign"? You know, next time.
It depends how successful the phishing campaign
is. I know.
All that is marketing, guys.
I know. It's like yes, the next company picnic. Click this link to sign up. Oh, my God. Please stop. Did you at least go to the internal SharePoint? No, it's a SurveyMonkey page. Why? Oh, God, somebody is paying for SurveyMonkey on a company card.
That'd be a way to do it, because a lot of corporate events are public. They want to say what good things they're doing. At this next corporate event, there's also going to be door prizes, guys.
Oh.
Click on this link to register to win your free smart TV or the newest iPhone.
Madman, we did that as a phishing test once. We only did that test once.
How many VPs did you get?
That's not the question. The question is, how many VPs did we have to buy a fucking smart TV for? Because they got really upset when they found out there wasn't a contest and raised hell about it.
But sir, you installed malware on a company machine. You don't get a smart TV. You get a bad dog, no biscuit. Where's the newspaper? We have to smack your nose and rub your face in it so you know what you did wrong.
They were threatening to fire large chunks of the IT department over that test. Because they thought it was real, And by God, somebody was getting a smart TV and an iPad. It's like, oh, for God's sake. So, yeah, somebody had to go buy a cheap-ass off-brand smart TV and whatever the last generation iPad was, because certainly nobody was going to spend real money on it. But, yeah, I mean, it was just people get really upset over this stuff.
Now, that needs to be in the white paper for an auditor to read. I know it didn't make it because it wouldn't have made it in my company. But that's what people need to know about.
Well, that was a medium size, well, small, medium to smallish company with a very small company attitude, and you know, some C levels who were very big for their britches, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, you know, click a phishing link, get entered for a drawing because some manager just got their tit in the ringer. It's like, my God, guys. So, anyways, next article. This one's from Bleeping Computer. Canon sued for disabling the scanner when the printer runs out of ink.
Oh, fuck you, Canon. Fuck you and the horse you rode in on. I hope you lose. And I need punitive damages.
Canon USA is being sued for not allowing owners of certain printers to use the scanner or faxing functions if they run out of ink. David Lee Kraft, a customer of Canon, filed a class action lawsuit on Tuesday, alleging deceptive marketing and unjust enrichment by the printing manufacturer. While using his Pixima MG6320 printer from Canon, so nobody buy that one, the plaintiff was surprised to discover that the all-in-one machine would refuse to scan or fax documents if the printer ran out of ink. As ink is not necessary to perform scans or faxes, the argument is that the printer feature should continue to work even if there is no ink in the device. Plaintiff Lee Kraft would not have purchased the device or would not have paid as much for it if he had known that he would have to maintain ink in the device in order to scan documents, reads the complaint for the class action. Which makes sense. How many people do you know under 30 who print everything out?
The last printer I had was mainly used for character sheets.
I'm probably going to set my laser printer up just for that purpose. But yes, that's it. I mean, it's like nobody prints everything out unless they're older. So I fully understand somebody who only maybe prints the occasional photo, not caring that they ran out of ink if they're mostly using it as a scanner.
Yeah, because the average human, I could see printing one set of documents every year, and that's because you should have a hard copy of your tax returns in a filing folder somewhere. But other than that, I could go an entire year without printing. And because I am not particularly responsible, I could probably go multiple years without printing.
DPView says, I bet you they have an auto order ink function enabled by default on the printer's nice JavaScript web page. And I think that's HP that automatically enrolls you in their ink order program. Not certain, but yeah. Well, especially when half the time replacing the ink is more expensive than the damned printer. I remember when we found the Lexmark printer at Walmart that was cheaper to buy a new printer than to replace the ink in it.
Yep, so, and when they stopped scanning serial numbers for that, it was easier to exchange it for the one that wasn't broken.
What's broken about? Not ran out of ink.
I would ever suggest anyone use Walmart's rental policy so abusively.
If you have to print that much, though, considering what ink costs. Actually, if you ever see any of the old infographics where they run the cost of printer ink by the barrel and compare it to other commodities, printer ink is the most valuable liquid in the world. That should tell you something.
Although, if I get another printer, I'm not going with ink. I'm getting something that uses toner. I don't print enough for ink. It goes bad. It just dries up in the cartridge.
No, laser printers are where it's at if you need one. So, also, you ever notice anything else about inkjets? They're only made by a handful of companies. That's because the patents for them are still going. Most of the toner-based machines, the patents have ran out, and that's why you see all kinds of different people making them.
That's so bizarre, because I figured lasers would be more recent than spraying ink onto a page.
Nope. Nope. Laser printer, toner-based electro-laser and just electromagnetic printers predate inkjet. Because the problem with inkjet was getting it fine enough to actually be usable as a printer. That's why the first ones were dot matrix, which were basically glorified typewriters hooked up to a computer. So, although they made a really fucking cool sound when you were like printing out a book.
Yes, they did.
And of course, you had the paper that was all connected together, so it was easier to do banners. You didn't have to tape everything together. Anyways,
you had to tear the little dots off the sides when you were done.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, reminiscing about days of playing with Print Shop Pro and the Commodore. Anyways, where was I? As ink is not necessary to perform scans or faxes, the argument is that the printer features should continue to work even if there's no ink in the device. Plaintiff Lee Craft would not have purchased the device or would not have paid as much for it had he known that he would have to maintain ink in the device in order to scan documents, reads the complaint for the class action lawsuit. Since at least 2016, other customers have contacted Canon about this exact problem and were told by support agents that ink cartridges must be installed and contain ink to use the printer's features, as shown by the agent's response below. So they've got an email from their support desk saying, yeah, you got to have ink in it to do anything. What's it say? Must have all ink tanks installed in the printer, and they must all contain ink to use the other functions of the printer. Replacing the empty ink tank with a new ink tank will resolve the issue. There is no workaround for this. Where's the button? Where's the button? The complaint further illustrates that with images of the Pixma MG2522 box that Canon advertises its all-in-one printers as including three distinct features: printing, copying, and scanning. However, there is no warning to show that ink is required for all these functions. Further posts found by Bleeping Computer also show Canon telling customers that all ink tanks must contain ink if they wish to print in grayscale, as it may damage the printer.
So not using color can damage the printer when I'm printing something that doesn't use color.
Well, that's the joke of how inkjet works, okay? When you're printing in color in many older inkjets, they make black by printing all of the colors at once. Now, they usually mix the black in with that to really get it dark. But yeah, they actually will use all of the ink to make the darks.
Oh, fuck you, because the color one's the expensive one.
Mm-hmm. No, inkjet, I mean, don't get me wrong, a good color photo printer is nice, but yeah, inkjet is not cheap anymore. And of course, it's even dying out even more nowadays, so rather than, you know, realizing that they're dealing with a low-end technology and pricing it appropriately to keep interest in it, they're instead jacking the price way the fuck up so that, you know, they can continue to try to maintain their profit margins.
But there's two ways to have a high profit margin. Well, high profits. One is sell a bunch of shit cheap instead of the one thing for $1 million. Well, I don't guess that could really apply, because it's also how often do you need a printer? So yeah. They can't go for the bulk sales at a low price. It is a niche item.
As such, the class action lawsuit states that the consumers have been deceived into buying a product that was designed to artificially and unethically introduce functional bottlenecks to tie them to ink levels, even if there's no practical link between them. Quote, as opposed to the single-function printers it sells, Canon calls these multifunction devices 3-in-1 or 4-in-1 for the fact that they purportedly provide three or four functions, unquote, reads a class action complaint against Canon. Quote, in truth, the all-in-one printers do not scan or fax documents when the devices have lower empty ink cartridges, the design issue, and Canon's advertising claims are false, misleading, and reasonably likely to deceive the public, unquote. According to the lawsuit, Canon is only doing this to increase its profits by selling replacement ink cartridges, hence the accusation for unjust enrichment. Considering that printer inks expire typically after 2 or 3 years, even if someone rarely or never prints in these all-in-one machines, they would practically be forced to keep buying new ink just to use all the functions of the device. Quote, there is no reason or technical bias technical basis for manufacturing the all-in-one printers with an ink level detection function that causes the scanner to stop functioning when the ink is low or empty. Canon designed the all-in-one printers in such a way to require customers to maintain ink in their devices regardless of whether they intend to print, unquote, continues the complaint. That's actually just shitty software design. That's not happening at the printer level. That's probably happening at the driver level. Well, I guess it depends on the device. Some of them have a little control board in them. But yeah, it's just shitty design where once the flag is tripped that, hey, you need ink, the machine just shuts down until you do it, until you give it ink. Which, if the device's primary function is to be a printer, kind of makes sense. But when you sell an all-in-one, you know, somebody might be using the scanner as the primary function and the printer is just when it's, you know, kind of nice. So I see where he's coming from with the lawsuit. Yeah, the result is an increase in ink sales with Canon, you know, in which Canon obtained significant profits. The lawsuit was filed in the District Court for the Eastern District of New York and seeks at least $5 million in awards, exclusive of interest, fees, and litigation costs. The alleged violations alleged in the complaint are New York General Business Law 349, New York General Business Law 350, breach of express warranties, unjust enrichment, failure to disclose material information. If you have bought an all-in-one printer from Canon and face similar problems, you could be eligible for receiving compensation in the future. However, it's important to note that this class action was filed this week and is not approved by the court yet, so it's too early in the process now. So, Bleeping Computer contacted Canon with questions regarding the lawsuit and has not received a response. That actually doesn't mean much. Usually when they say, oh, we attempted to contact them but didn't get a response before publication, the author might have sent the email 5 minutes before sending it to their editors. You know, unless they responded with no comment, or responded saying we have no comment, you know, or they give the time frame. If an author says, well, we tried to reach them and didn't get a response, I don't put much stock into that because they could have, you know, sent it like a minute before they published it. But, because apparently some people were doing that. And then publishing the corrections later when they got them. But, printer software has sucked for a long time now. That's one of the reasons why I like getting my hands on old printers. I mentioned my laser printer before. It's a little brother laser printer, black and white. I think it's 10 years old, and it works with everything because it's that old, and everything's got a driver for it, and I don't need any goofy shit to run it. I've used a Raspberry Pi as a print server with it before. No problems. Probably going to do so again if I decide to get it out again. So, yeah. And, of course, the toner in it. I think I've put new toner in it once. 10 years old.
Looking. Their laser printers really aren't that bad. I see a platinum printer for $99.
Yeah, make sure it's probably only black and white. Usually the color lasers are usually a couple $100. But, again, it's probably worth it. Usually the drivers aren't as shit for lasers, too. Because they expect them to go in a business environment, not somebody's home office. So usually the home ones that are targeted to home users are the ones that are bloated down with the auto ink ordering and all the bullshit. My favorite was the one that tried to make sure it printed something every day so that it would run you through ink faster. Had like this like newsletter subscription thing where it would print out like, you know, some little newsletter from the company every day, which 9 times out of 10 was just a big ad. So, how do I know about that one? Well, I have a grandmother.
Keeps printing this.
Yeah, that's basically what the phone call was. It's like, how do I turn this off? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have one of those things. And we finally figured it out. She, I mean, to this day she still has problems with printers. I hate printers. I hate trying to fix printers. My God. Because 9 times out of 10, it's just shitty drivers. Or the stupid little add-on software they use just takes over some function on Windows that worked fine. Next article is from The Guardian. France hails victory as Facebook agrees to pay newspapers for content. I'm following up with this, even though I was complaining about all the Facebook articles earlier, because we talked about this before when they were fighting it. This is basically forcing Facebook to pay news articles for links, you know, when they link to articles and stuff online. And it's not even Facebook linking to them. It's usually their users posting stories. France has hailed a victory in its long-running quest for fairer action from tech companies after Facebook reached an agreement with a group of national and regional newspapers to pay for content shared by its users. Facebook on Thursday announced a licensing agreement with the APIG, Alliance of French National and Regional Newspapers, which includes Les Partisan and Oist France, as well as smaller titles. It said this meant, quote, people on Facebook will continue to be able to upload or will be able to continue uploading and sharing news stories freely among their communities while also ensuring the copyright of our publishing partners is protected, unquote. Yeah, that's not what that is. That's we can't get a subscription fee out of the people anymore, so now we're going to get it out of the tech companies because they have money. I mean, that's the original articles. That's what it read like, was just, oh, they have money. Let's get it from them. Here's a flimsy bias. People are posting links on their service. France, what? Yeah, they didn't surrender. What a surprise, right? France has been battling for 2 years to protect the publishing rights and revenue of its press and news agencies from what it termed the domination of powerful tech companies that share new content or show news stories in web searches. That was the one that always bothered me, is that they show it in web searches. It's like we've covered all that before, but it's weird to me to say, you know, you can't link to them unless you pay them for their content, because linking to them is free advertising. Unless somebody's copying and pasting the text out of the stories.
That I would say it depends on how much is showing up on the search. If it's just the headline, then I could see not having an argument. But if the search pulls up the entire article and you're bypassing the ad revenue on the page,
yeah,
I could see them having an argument because you're taking their work without giving them quote-unquote agreed-upon means of recompense.
No, he's not reading it from a law. let's see. 2019, France became the first EU company to enact a directive on the publishing rights of media companies and news agencies called neighboring rights, which require large tech platforms to open talks with publishers seeking remuneration for the use of news content. But it has taken long negotiations to reach agreements on paying publishers for content. Well, I mean, yeah, when they were getting all this stuff for free before, why would they pay for it? No detail was given on the exact amount agreed by Facebook and the APIG. Pierre Louet, head of the media group Les Echos Le Partisan, and if I'm mispronouncing this stuff, I'm sorry, but not that sorry, led the alliance of newspapers who negotiated as a group with Facebook. He said the agreement was, quote, the result of an outspoken and fruitful dialogue between the publishers and a leading digital platform, unquote. He said that the terms agreed would allow Facebook to implement French law, quote, while generating significant funding, unquote, for news publishers, notably the smaller ones. In other words, we're getting a lot of money out of Facebook, so we're happy. I'm sure Facebook is thrilled about this. Other newspapers, such as the National Daily Le Monde, have negotiated their own deals in recent months. News agencies have also negotiated separately. After the 2019 French directive to protect publishers' rights, a copyright spat raged on for more than a year, in which French media groups sought to find common ground with international tech firms. Google initially refused to comply, saying media groups already benefited by receiving millions of visits from their websites. News outlets struggling with dwindling print subscriptions complained about not receiving a cut of the millions made from ads displayed alongside news stories, particularly on Google. But this year, Google announced that it reached a draft agreement with the APIG to pay publishers for a selection of content shown in its searches. Facebook said that besides paying for French content, it would also launch a French news service, Facebook News, in January, a follow-up to similar services in the US and UK, to, quote, give people a dedicated space to access content from trusted and reputable news sources, unquote. Facebook reached deals with most of Australia's largest media companies earlier this year. Nine Entertainment, which includes the Sydney Morning Herald and Age, and said in its annual report that it was expecting, quote, strong growth in the short term, unquote, from its deals with Facebook and Google. British newspapers, including The Guardian, signed up last year to a program in which Facebook pays to license articles that appear on a dedicated news section of the social media site. Separately, in July, Guardian Australia struck a deal with Facebook to license news content. So, I don't, like, I'm not a fan of Facebook in this, or Google for that matter, but I think it's a little weird. I have a hard time with this concept of getting Facebook and Google to pay these newspapers for content. I mean, I guess these agreements might be more than I'm reading into them, but it sounds to me like they're paying them for the right to link. And I feel like that has potential to be taken way too far. You know, I post the links to the articles I read on this show, because I want you to see where I'm getting it from, because I don't want anybody to accuse me of making stuff up or picking a bad source. I'm saying, here's my sources. So if you don't like a source, that's why. There you go. It's not me. It's just I've picked a I might have happened to pick a website that wasn't so good, or if you didn't, you know, if you wanted to follow up on something, you can see where I got it from. And so if somebody reported it wrong there, that's why I said it. That's why I do it. But I'm not going to, I don't want to have to pay all these people for the content, because then I couldn't do this show.
Check something. Facebook's news feed direct me to the site when I click on the link, or does it just pull up a story on their site?
I don't know.
Does the links that you're posting, when I click on it, I'm at NPR, I'm at Bleeping Computer.
Yeah, and you're going to see any ads they have. Yeah,
on Bleeping Computer or NPR.
Assuming you haven't installed uBlock Origin like a good person.
Yeah, assuming this. And we're going to assume this for this argument.
For legal reasons, yes.
Damn it. I am so not a Facebook user that when I open up Facebook, I have trouble.
I refuse to log into it on any of my primary machines. I have some uses for it, but it requires a dedicated virtual machine that doesn't do anything else, because I don't want to risk cross-contamination. I made the mistake of signing into Facebook through the web browser, mind you, on an Android phone once. Oh my God. Getting that account out of everything took so long. Because it kept trying to auto-log in. It was in all these different places. And because it saved this account across all these different places, I would log out of Facebook proper and log out of the ones I knew about and click something else, and it would log me back into all of them and recreating all the damn cookies. I mean, it's like once you're in, it's hard to get your phone out. Finally got them all, but it took a while. It also took disabling some of the Facebook services that apparently Samsung pre-installs on the phone. I mean, it was a pain in the ass.
I just checked, and the link, it takes you to that site. So the argument I was going to make isn't going to be valid, because I was going to say if they're copying the articles and denying the site the ad revenue from going to that site has an argument. Because the reason Facebook got so popular, well, one of the reasons is you didn't have to search and bookmark 12 sites to get your news. Just scroll down the news feed, and it became your favorites tab. But clicking on the articles, I've gone to Reuters, I've gone to NBC, and I've gone to Fox. and I've gone now to the AP as well. It actually, when you click on the article, it directs you to the site, read the full article. The only thing you can see on Facebook is the headline and the news source. So I can see a story from AP, Moscow closing schools, many businesses as virus death soar. That's all you get. So if all you're going to read are the headlines, which no one should do, because that is deceptive as fuck. I have read articles from many different news agencies where if you just read the headline, you would think the exact opposite of what was actually in the story. It's like the fourth paragraph down, it contradicts everything from the previous three paragraphs in a five-paragraph article.
So, yeah, I mean, but you see why I think that's weird, because I feel like this is more of a cash grab and just going, oh, these big guys have money, we can get it out of them, rather than a legitimate argument for, you know, services or something.
I can see that on Facebook's part. I do go back and forth on Google because Google is crowded out almost all the other advertising agencies on the internet.
Yeah.
So they're now dictating how much they're going to give you for the ad revenue on your site. That's why a lot of sites, my chagrin, have gone to the subscription model of where if you want to read everything, pay us. And that's because there might be 5 cents worth of revenue generated from each one of these ads, but we're only getting 1 cent out of every 30 ads shown because Google's taking the rest of it.
Yeah.
So I can see an argument from a monopoly side, but I just checked Facebook. They're sending you to the site. You're getting whatever ad, that site's getting whatever ad revenue they're supposed to be getting. Facebook's not screwing them up. And I hate to say that because Facebook is fucking cancer.
Yeah, you see why I'm conflicted about this, because I don't like these companies. But I want, if somebody's going to take down Facebook, I want it to be for a legitimate reason. I don't want it to be just because we've decided Facebook is bad and evil. I want it to, you know, have some basis in...
Yeah, it's
in,
like, this is why they're bad and evil, and this is why we're taking them down. This ad thing, Facebook is sending you to the site. They're not screwing people over.
Yeah, I mean, they're screwing you over with the algorithm. They're screwing you over with the data collection. They're buying up every damn competitor, which that, the freaking FTC and a few other people ought to be looking into any acquisition Facebook wants to make. They should not be allowed to buy competing social media networks. But Google
possibly take some antitrust there and have them give up a lot of their properties.
I would not be against that, because I think you could make monopoly arguments for Facebook and Google right now.
Like the Sherman Antitrust Act hasn't been used in a while, and I do think that's who did it. Right? Either way, Antitrust Act.
Yeah, I think that's I think that would be appropriate to go after them with, because. I mean, am I going to say that Facebook is a true monopoly? No. But, you know, what are the competing social networks?
The monopolies they went after
networks?
Weren't true monopolies.
Yeah. I mean,
the only true monopolies are government-backed monopolies.
Yeah, there are competitors to Facebook, but, you know, I've heard more and more that apparently Facebook, Google, Twitter, Adobe, Oracle, and Microsoft all have apparently made some pretty interesting arrangements with several of the intelligence agencies, and that it might not have been as a level playing field as it appeared when these guys were coming up, you know, in the start of the internet age. So, especially Facebook, because apparently they made some very interesting data sharing deals with some of the intelligence agencies. So they've kind of been protected, if you know what I mean. So I wouldn't mind seeing them get an antitrust case going. Do I expect them to get broken up? No, I expect them to fight back and throw enough money at it to make it go away and grease the right politicians. But at least put the fear of it into them so they behave a little better, you know? So, anyways.
Next up
is from xdadevelopers.com. When Windows 11 launched a couple of weeks ago, there were a few notable issues with the new versions of the OS. Two, in particular, got the most attention, which affected AMD processors specifically. One decreased the performance of the L3 cache in AMD processors. The other affected the preferred core feature of those CPUs. Today, fixes for both issues are available to the general public, with AMD releasing a brand new fix for the preferred core issue in Windows 11. Typically, processors can detect which is the best core currently available and assign a thread to it. While the different cores in the CPU are meant to be identical, there are always slight variations, and this feature, called Preferred Core, allowed CPUs to choose the best performing cores for any given task. And actually, that's not true anymore. You're seeing it more on like the Apple M1 stuff, but I think Intel's looking at it too, where they're looking at making high cores and low cores, mainly for laptops for energy efficiency. So, you know, if you've got just some background processors running, you can put those on the low power cores. And then if you're doing some serious number crunching, you run that on the high power cores. So this preferred core feature is important, much more important than this article makes it sound of saying, oh, you know, some cores are a little bit better than others. Well, they're intentionally doing that. And actually, I think mobile devices are doing that too, ARM chips. So, you know, that's actually pretty important, because you're going to see more and more of that. After the Windows 11 update, AMD processors could no longer use the preferred core feature and instead assigned tasks to random cores, which could result in slightly lower performance for tasks that only used one or a few cores. With the new AMD Ryzen chipset driver update, version 3.10.8.506, this problem should now be fixed and threads should once again be assigned to the appropriate core. While the driver update is mostly targeting Windows 11, you can still install it on Windows 10 if you want. To see if you have it installed, you check apps and features, AMD chipset, blah, 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 blah. As for the L3 cache problem, it's simply a matter of increased latency when accessing the cache built into AMD processors. While a fix was made available to Windows Insiders last week, you can now download it manually and install it on the Windows or on the stable Windows 11 release. The update is KB5006746 and changes the build number to 22000.828, the same build Windows Insiders got. You can download the update manually or check the list of optional updates for your Windows 11 PC. The update will also be included in next month's Patch Tuesday, which is mandatory. There have been a few more issues found in Windows 11 since it launched, including one that may cause Windows 11 to ask users for administrative privileges when attempting to print anything on a print server. Oh my God. Talk about bad user training. Alongside the fix to the L3 cache issue on AMD processors, last week's update for Windows Insiders in the beta channel included many more fixes, but that particular problem has yet to be solved. Okay, yeah, that, and then the update that they got the L3 cache issue fixed. So whoever updated the article didn't do a great job at it. But so we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that Ryzen users were seeing like a 10 to 15% performance penalty for upgrading to Windows 11. So it looks like they've gotten that sorted out. And this is why you see most companies take years before they start going to the next version of Windows. Because it can take that long before they've got all the little crap worked out and all the hardware makers have gotten caught up to where buying a new round of laptops with the new OS actually, you know, you have a shot that it might be reliable. So, anyways,
I'm going to make the same crack I made the last time we covered this story. So do you think AMD just didn't grease enough palms, or did Intel just give them more money than AMD did?
I'd be willing to bet AMD didn't. Well, I don't know that it would be directly greasing enough palms, but I bet Intel just gives Microsoft all kinds of hardware to test for the new updates to the OS. And I'm wondering if AMD didn't do that enough. So, I mean, you would think somebody at Microsoft would do this kind of testing, but over the past couple of versions of Windows, Microsoft has basically gutted their internal testing teams and now kind of rely on end users doing the beta channels to test things. So it's also possible that just not enough enthusiasts were testing, you know, not enough people with AMD chips were doing the testing early Windows builds because, you know, God forbid Microsoft actually pay their testers. No, their customers will be their beta testers now. This is why Windows 11 is released rather than still in beta, because it sounds to me like it's a flipping beta. So, but, you know, a lot of companies are going that way because it's cheaper. Gets the product out there faster.
Remember when everyone wanted to be a beta tester? I wasn't one of those idiots.
Oh, I enjoyed beta testing things, but, you know, beta testing it in places where it made sense. You know, on the extra machine or on my home, you know, on my machine that I didn't care if I'd had to format and reinstall once a week. And now that I think about it, I routinely did. Yeah, that used to be about an every 3 month exercise, reinstall Windows XP. I remember that. So, had a great version of the Windows XP install disk, and a pirated key already on it, and a bunch of software because I was reinstalling often enough, it made sense. Last article for tonight is from Vice. Man arrested for uncensoring Japanese porn with AI in the first deepfake case. This is almost more of an IHN story, but I mean, my God.
He unpixelated the bukkake?
Yep.
How dare he?
Japanese police on Monday. What do you do? Get the little bar off of their face? Or do they still do that?
No, they pixelate the bukkake.
Hmm. Didn't they used to put, like, the bar across the eyes, supposedly hiding who they were?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay, I might be thinking of something else. Japanese police on Monday arrested a 43-year-old man for using artificial intelligence to effectively unblur pixelated porn videos in the first criminal case in the country involving the exploitive use of powerful technology. Okay, I would not have phrased it like that.
I don't see this as exploitative, seeing as how the chick agreed to be naked, and if the dude's ashamed of how big his dick is, he should not be in a porno. No, wait a minute. He should be in a porno because it can make every other guy feel better.
I'm just... Okay, if you're using AI, you're technically having the computer recreate an artistic interpretation of what was behind the censorship. It's not a real photo. It might be close enough to not be able to tell the difference, but you're asking the computer to redraw what was censored out, right?
I'm following.
So if you are an artist and you just, you know, look at a celebrity and draw a picture of what they might look like naked and then try to sell the painting, I mean, yeah, it's kind of, you know, you're kind of taking advantage of somebody's image without permission, but it's not like a photo, it's a drawing, you know, it's something that's being created. I'm not certain, well, let's read more of the article and see here, because I'm not certain that, I'm a little worried if they go overbroad on the reaction to this, we get another Digital Millennium Copyright Act where the law is just not really fit, doesn't really fit the technology anymore. Because this stuff, all this AI stuff is early days. You know, they're running it on graphics cards. They're just starting to figure out what they can do with it. Yeah, the photo stuff is kind of interesting. And, you know, the art generators and, you know, this noise canceling and some of the other stuff you can do with it's powerful. But it's really, and they all call it AI, it's really data modeling. So I'm a little concerned that... I'm concerned we're going to get new laws that we don't need, because if you're going to say that producing an accurate enough representation of somebody's image without their permission is some kind of a crime, you know, you outlaw somebody drawing a cartoon of somebody, right? So,
yeah.
You know, yeah, it's reductionist to make that argument, but at the same, I'm not saying I agree with the guy using the AI to, you know, uncensor porn. I'm just I don't want to see the technology limited by bad law, and this seems like something that could go in that direction. I don't know if I'm explaining that well. But
I'm just wondering if he's going to claim defamatory. My bukkake is 4 inches larger than this.
Oh, my God. Oh, well, let's get in. Let's read the article here. Masayaki Nakamoto, who runs his own website in the southern prefecture of Hyogo, lifted images of porn stars from Japanese adult videos and doctored them with the same method used to create realistic face swaps in deepfake videos. But instead of changing faces, Nakamoto used machine learning software to reconstruct the blurred parts of the video based on a large set of uncensored nudes and sold the content online. Penises and vaginas are pixelated in Japanese porn because of an obscenity law forbids the explicit depictions of genitalia. Nakamoto reportedly made about 11 million yen, or about $96,000, by selling over 10,000 manipulated videos, though he was arrested specifically for selling 10 fake photos at about 2,300 yen, or $20 apiece. Nakamoto pleaded guilty to charges of copyright violation and displaying obscene images and said he did it for money, according to NHK. He was caught when the police conducted a cyber patrol, the Japanese broadcaster reported. Photorealistic images created using AI are increasingly common and have raised many legal and ethical questions concerning privacy, sexual exploitation, copyright, and artistic expression. Quote, this is the first case in Japan where police have caught an AI user, Daisuke Tsuyoshi, a lawyer who's tried cybercrime crisis, told Vice World News, quote, at the moment, there's no law criminalizing the use of AI to make such images, unquote. Well, they're also getting him on the, so apparently in Japan, it is illegal to even draw a dick, because I guess that violates the obscenity law, and since AI, this AI is effectively having the computer do the drawing for you, I guess that already violates that law. So, globally, victims of doctored videos, often women, and governments are grappling with proliferation of deepfakes. In Taiwan, a man was arrested also on Monday for selling deepfake porn on a Telegram group with some 6,000 members. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen called the crime online sex violence. Violence? Really?
I wouldn't say it's violence. Violence is being punched in the face.
Yeah, I mean, was somebody on the ground bleeding because of this? And said that she would consider legislation against it. Quote, these victims could be people you and I care about. Well, they could be. They could be a lot of things. I mean, just, I'm sorry, I hate arguments like that. These victims could be people you and I care about. But if they're not, who cares? Fuck them, right? they could be our families and friends. We can't sit on the sidelines, Tsai said in a Facebook post. Tsai also linked the use of technology to the threat posed by fake videos and fake information to democracy. Potential using of deep fakes to sow mistrust and manipulate public opinion was demonstrated as early as 2018 when a viral video showed former U.S. President Barack Obama calling his successor Donald Trump a total and complete dipshit. I wish I had seen that video. That sounds funny. You just get somebody impersonating Obama's voice and put it over, do one of those. It's probably one of those ones that, like, takes the single photo like you would do for the singing one or whatever. So, that still sounds funny. The next year, California banned political deepfakes within 60 days of an election to combat potential campaign misinformation. So far, as in Nakamoto's case, deepfake technology has been used overwhelmingly to simulate pornographic videos. According to Sensity, a startup that offers fake video detection services, 96% of deepfake videos depicted non-consensual pornography in 2019. Non-consensual pornography. I guess that's what we call voyeurism now. In fact, the Reddit users credited with propelling deepfakes into the mainstream used this technology to swap female celebrities' faces onto porn videos. Such use has led to numerous cases of victims fighting to remove compromising fake videos from the internet. In India, a gang allegedly blackmailed people by threatening to send deepfake videos of them to their families. So, I think we did that story. Tsuyoshi said criminalizing the use of fake deepfake software or similar technology is not the right answer to the problem, as the tools themselves could be used for legitimate purposes. Yeah, what do you think de-aging technology in videos is? Like, you know, in Hollywood, when they make an old actor look young? That's the same stuff.
FBI uses that to track down victims.
Yeah, that too. I mean, it's the same damn software. They're just, you know, instead of swapping it for a different actor, they're just swapping it for a younger version of the same actor. It's the same thing. Using AI to lift mosaics isn't what's wrong. It's how the suspect Nakamoto used AI, he said. But given cases of copyright infringement or exploitation of a person's privacy, Tsuyoshi said it was necessary to introduce laws that restrict how, not whether, deepfake technology is used. Well, I mean, they've got the same concerns I do that, you know, you don't want to write bad law around this, but they're likely going to. So.
One issue is they're not writing law. Whenever it goes to the courts, you're not writing law, you're setting precedent. And that can be even worse. Instead of having 20 idiots in a room where one of them might know what they're doing and try to curtail things, you have one idiot taking care of it. And it can be harder to overturn precedent than it is to just repeal a law.
Well, that's good and terrifying. Thanks, Madman.
Oh, don't worry. I had to, you know, pick up your slack for not making this as gloomy as it should be. But I can take care of it, my friend.
You know, I don't intentionally try to make everything gloomy, but here lately, trying to get stories that weren't just, you know, Facebook sucks. I mean,
I don't know. I think I kind of liked a bit Kalota Bukaki story. Nice to know if I ever want unsimulated Japanese porn, it's out there.
You know, the dojo sound might not have been the best thing to play when we're talking about uncensored Japanese porn.
I just figured everyone did the same thing normal people did. They went and looked at Korean porn. Can you really tell the difference between a Japanese person and a Korean person? And yes, I'm saying they both look alike.
I mean, I couldn't tell you which one's Japanese and which one's Korean. I'm sure a Japanese or Korean person could.
I'm not. It's like pulling up some Scotsman and some Irishman. So, like, telling me which one's a Scotsman and which one's an Irishman. And if they keep their mouth shut, good fucking luck.
I mean...
Not racist. White people look the same, too.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm kind of retarded.
Okay.
Yeah, this dude could have just saved himself some trouble by reposting Korean porn. Next story.
Well, at least they're using an existing law in Japan and not trying to come up with something new. So, anyways. So, two things for you tonight in Dojo. The first is actually pretty cool. Loftcrack, which is one of the original password brooding tools, has been, you know, you've had to buy it for years. And... You know, it started out as a password brooder, then it was using rainbow tables, now it's doing the GPU stuff, and it's been through several different owners because the original guys who made it started a consultancy, they merged with another consultancy, that consultancy got bought by Symantec, then they formed another company and bought the tool back from Symantec and then sold it commercially for a while. And I think they were going to sell it to somebody else, and then that fell through. And so now it's been repossessed, is what they've said, and they're open sourcing it. So this is actually pretty cool because Loftcrack is one of those old school tools that you used to, I mean that used to be in the toolkit there next to Metasploit and a few other things that you would just always have if you did pen tests often enough. I often use the open source kind of knockoff called Oftcrack back in the day when I was using this stuff more often, which was basically a pure rainbow table and a minor brooding tool. But Loftcrack, you know, they support, you know, it's kind of all wrapped up in one package. It'll do the GPU brooding, it does regular brooding, does rainbow tables, and now they've open sourced it. So we're probably going to see a ton of forks of it and all kinds of new stuff coming back into it. So that's pretty cool, actually, kind of seeing that out there is open source nowadays. So I don't know if the people originally running it just kind of got tired of treating it as a commercial tool or, you know, maybe they're moving on to better things or maybe they just don't think it's that important anymore and, you know, throw it out there. So either way, yeah, they've They're not going to do any support for it anymore. They're not going to sell any new licenses. They're just, here's the open source version of it. Have at it. So that's pretty cool. And I need to play with it some because I haven't messed with Loftcrack in a long time. And then the final thing I have for you in Dojo tonight is a link to a Lifehacker article. You know, they're talking about, oh, your iPhone has secret codes in it. And these are the service numbers built in where you dial certain codes on the dial pad. You can get things like your carrier details, your IMEI, enabling call waiting and trying to block outgoing calls, show your, place anonymous calls so you don't see your caller ID information. This is stuff you've been able to do for years. Most of it will work on Android phones too, not just iPhones. It might be different on Android phones. All of your phones have had these kind of codes in them for years. One of the feature phones I used to have back in the day, I think it was an LG phone, had a really cool one where you would punch in a series of numbers and then a couple of hashtags, and it would bring up kind of a signal map where it would show how strong the signal is and approximate on the little screen almost a map of where the towers were. I don't know how accurate it was, but it was cool looking. So, you know, phones have had these in them forever, but it's a fun article. It's good to go through and look at it and see that these codes do exist. If they may not be the same across different phones, but at least tells you something to Google if you're trying to figure out, you know, your phone model and then the dial codes to see things like, you know, your signal strength, your IMEI, that kind of thing. So, anyways, fun little article. Nothing new, really, especially if you've done any deep diving into cell phones. But, it's good to know about.
It also changed the phone number to transmits when you call out.
Yeah, you can do that. There's all kinds of little crap you can do with those dial codes. So, you know, like I said, it's good to know about.
I got somebody calling me from Wingdings once, and I got a kick out of it.
Nice. So, of course, that's all we've got. Listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 radio site and subreddit Mad Men. Closing thoughts.
Oh. Be careful who you let watch Amazon Prime videos on your account. Not because they're going to watch something strange. Just, you don't always want to know their buying habits if they want to take advantage of the Prime shipping.
You getting some strange advertisements now, Medman?
Not quite strange advertisements. I'm just, I have family members whom I used to change their diapers, and now they want to show off womanly assets, and I'm seeing a dress that they left in the cart while I was seeing how much a laser printer costs.
Gladys is dead to me now. I can have any blow-up doll I want.
So, all right, that's all I've got. let's see. Oh, in the IRC tonight, Psychros, DP View, myself, and Madman. And now we're going to play the sound effects and close out the show.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Sounds good. Nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.